For the week of February 2nd, 2020, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 479, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Pensacola, Florida, I'm Michael Giltz.
I'm tempted to ask what you're doing in Pensacola, but I'm afraid to ask.
Why?
I don't know. I don't know what you're doing there.
Florida man. I am here. My sister had shoulder surgery at the Andrews Orthopedics, one of the best in the world, really. They have a lot of professional athletes come from all over the world to get surgery done here. She had some work done, and my mom and I are here helping her with her recovery. Everything went great. She's doing terrific and going to head home back to London in a few days.
Well, I'm glad to hear everything went well. Things did not go well at the start of last week's episode, Michael. You might have noticed that I said all the news making Hollywood, not headlines. And like three people have emailed me already, to at least three people.
Last week was a disaster. We couldn't hear each other. We kept talking over each other. We couldn't go back. It was a technical disaster.
So it was what we like to call a normal show.
That's right. So now who won? Who do you think won the Super Bowl, Sperling?
I think Google won the Super Bowl. I thought their ad was, it brought a tear to my eye.
But who won the halftime show? Was it J-Lo or Shakira?
I think Shakira probably won. She was the one, you know, running around with the guitar and the drums. Did she really play all those instruments, or was that just like,
that was
for
like
show?
Lip playing, I think.
Yeah. Okay. You know, but even my daughters were like, she plays guitar. I said, really? Look at how many chords she knows. And they were like, she's not really strumming, is she?
That's
like,
right. Yeah. And kids in cages at one moment in there, right?
Oh, yes, that's true. They did kind of have a little
political there. Two Latina women working it hard. J-Lo boasting a Puerto Rican flag sort of boa thing while singing Born in the USA. You had Shakira. You had J Balvin and Bad Bunny, two artists on my best of the year list, doing cameos. It was a flashy, sexy, fun halftime show with a little bit of a political message.
And also, no clothes. Or actually, a lot of clothes. They kept coming off, and there were different costume changes, but I would also say no clothes. Here was my comment on Twitter, where I am, by the way, at Sperling, if you want to follow me. But what I said is, you know, years ago, in 2004, you had Janet Jackson, and the nipple thing was a problem, and apparently, you know, Jennifer Lopez wearing basically nothing and running around, you know, spinning on a stripper pole, that was okay.
That's America.
Yeah, unbelievable.
And apparently there was also football. But anyway, moving on with the show, what are we
don't know how many people watched it, though, because we're recording on Sunday night. Although we do know, I think the official number is a lot of people watched it.
98 to 103 million, of course, something like that. Who knows?
Yeah.
But I bet a lot of people tuned in for the halftime show, and then a lot of them will tune into our show. What will they hear about this week?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we've got award news from Sundance, awards from BAFTA, that's right, those awards that are given out in London, awards from the WGA, the Writers Guild, and of course, a preview of the Oscars happening this Sunday. And by this Sunday, I mean next Sunday. In the Middle Kingdom, the coronavirus is dominating news as it is declared a worldwide health crisis and upends businesses everywhere, not least of which the entertainment business. And actually, I think they're saying it might become a pandemic. On Inside Baseball, we'll look at the big deals announced at Sundance and what they say about the new dominance of streamers. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on last week's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. Then we pull information from everywhere, from China charts, which aren't available yet, so we're missing some of that data, from charts for India, North American charts, Box Office Mojo, Box Office Profit, Deadline, LA Times, New York Times, The Hollywood Reporter, Variety, you, our listener. And the number one movie around the world for the second week in a row is Bad Boys for Life. Will Smith is back on top. $75 million it made this week. They're about to pass the $300 million mark.
Well, I can tell you that here's your China charts, zero. Okay. Yeah. And that's because all of the movie theaters are closed. There are no movie theaters there are very few movie theaters that are open. And in the 3 days that launched the Lunar New Year in 2019, the Chinese box office took in $507 million, okay? This year, the first 3 days of the Lunar New Year, Chinese New Year, $2 million.
Yeah, it looks like Valentine's Day, those movies might get canceled. The movie schedule, of course, is chaotic. Hong Kong has the 1-2 punch of protests that have been going on and now coronavirus. Flights out of China have been canceled by some countries, including the United States. Film shoots.
You mean flights into China?
Well, and out. They're not letting people from China come into the U.S.
Oh, well, that's true, too. Yeah.
No, film shoots and TV shoots throughout China look like they have been canceled and put on hold. Two movies now have jumped from theatrical movie to streaming. The big franchise Lost in Russia and a comedy called Enter the Fat Dragon. And there's some resentment from theater owners who see these companies capitalizing out of a disaster to sort of make a push for streaming and to say, hey, join our streaming service. You know, they're not happy about someone saying, hey, sign up for Netflix. You know, you can't go to the movies. They find that tacky, if that's the right word.
Is Netflix in China? I guess.
I just made that as an example. Okay. No, they are not. I couldn't think of the company that was doing that with Lost in Russia. They in particular were getting some pushback from theaters who were saying, we don't appreciate that. It's a big problem. And of course, hundreds of people have died around the world. It's a very serious health crisis. We're looking at it through the lens of the entertainment business, but it's a lot more serious than that.
So how does this affect films and producers and distributors? Well, really, distributors, they all have to distribute through a Chinese distributor. But certainly filmmakers and producers around the world are trying to distribute movies in China. The problem is some of those films had play dates, you know, release dates already on the calendar. Well, guess what? All of those are going to start shifting around now.
Because, right. It's going to be chaos. They'll move to later in the year. Movies later in the year will move to next year. It's just going to have a big domino effect. It's not going to shake out until, you know, life gets back to normal and people can start going to the movies again. So we're not going to know what's going to go on with this for weeks, if not months.
Well, that's true. And, you know, let's hope that it is, you know, a week rather than weeks. But I think you're probably right. It will be weeks.
Yeah, that's right. Back to the charts. At number two around the world is the World War One film 1917. That triumphed at the BAFTAs with 7 awards. At the box office worldwide, it made another $50 million. It's at $250 million and counting. Right below that is Doolittle, the Robert Downey Jr. family-friendly flick. $35 million it made this week. It's at $125 million worldwide.
Now, you know what Doolittle is not friendly towards? Bottom line.
Quality?
Yeah, profits. Yeah.
Well, Jumanji is profitable. Jumanji, The Next Level, made another $17 million. Not as much as the first one in this reboot, but it's at $750 million worldwide.
You know they're not going to make another one now that it's not as profitable as the first. That was it. They're done. They're going home. They're never making another. That's Jumanji's over. Forget about it.
Well, Little Women is a perennial that always gets remade for each new generation. This time around, it's been a very successful film. $16 million it made this week. It's now at $162 million worldwide. I'm not sure about the budget for Guy Ritchie's crime drama, The Gentlemen, but that's about to hit $50 million worldwide. I imagine it was made for a dime, but we'll have to get more info on that. Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker, that's still past $1 billion. And Frozen 2, that's at $1.43 billion. That's just a tremendously big hit. And in a much smaller scale, Jojo Rabbit is also a big hit. That made another $10 million this week. It's at $65 million worldwide, and it's got a long ways to go. It's opened up in a lot of territories. It's got Germany ahead of it. This is a success story on every level because it only costs $14 million to make. Will Smith has a second film on the charts. It's the cartoon Spies in Disguise. That's at $160 million worldwide. And that Korean drama, The Man Standing Next, that's about the assassination of the president in 1979, that made another $9 million this week. That's at $24 million and counting. And of course, the scheduling in China will affect Korea and Japan and India and other countries because Chinese movies come to those countries and movies in those countries play in China. They may end up losing their opportunity to open in China because other movies will be backlogged behind them. So it's going to affect not just the Chinese market, not just people opening movies there, but also movies in other countries all over the world.
By the way, you asked about the budget of The Gentlemen. Mm-hmm. It is it is roughly between $20 and $25 million.
So it's looking good. I mean, it's at $50 million right now. It's clearly going to get to $75 million worldwide. So that's in good shape, I would say.
I would agree.
All right. Right below The Man Standing Next is another Korean film, Parasite. You know that one. Another big winner at the BAFTAs, poised for Oscar success come next Sunday night. That's at $165 million. Then there are one, two, three, four films that made $7 million. The horror flick Gretel and Hansel opened up here in North America at $7 million. The Jamie Foxx, Michael B. Jordan film about capital punishment, Just Mercy, that made another $7 million. It's at $37 million. Right below that is Knives Out. That, too, made $7 million. That's about to hit $300 million worldwide. And then Tanhaji, The Unsung Warrior, the Bollywood film. I think it's Bollywood. I apologize if that's not right. But it is from India, and it's hitting $45 million worldwide. Then Bombshell, the once Oscar hopeful, has made $6 million over the weekend. It's at $46 million worldwide. That's looking like it's slowing down and stopping. It's not going to be a...
Wait, didn't somebody, one of the actresses got a...
Yes, but they were hoping for picture and director and all that stuff. They're up for one award or two awards rather than, you know, picture, director and all that. So this movie is fading a bit at the box office. It's not going to hit, I don't think, the $90, $100 million it needs to be a hit. At the box office alone, it could still, of course, break even or make some money when all is said and done, but this is not going to be an out-and-out hit. Certainly, that's the case for the horror, The Turning, which got terrible reviews, but nonetheless, it's making a little bit of money. It's at $13 million, and when you're a horror flick and you're made on a dime, that can be okay.
It did get an F cinema score, so that must F for fantastic, right? I
mean, that's exactly right. And Cats is terrific. I don't know what you would say about Cats, but that's at $70 million worldwide. Scrolling down, a couple new films here. Odio l'estate, that's an Italian film. I hate summer. It's about three families who show up at a summer rental house. And they're all in this, booked into the same house. And the local police chief is like, you're stuck together. What can I say? And so they all have to, you know, make do. And I'm guessing there's fights and arguments and romance. And they all become friends at the end. At least that's what the trailer in Italian suggested to me. Again, Hollywood, ripe for me.
I was just going to say, Michael, I'm going to have to stop this show because I have to call an agent. I don't care which agent. I just need to buy the rights to that because that sounds ripe for a remake. And by the way, if that's not what the movie is about, congratulations, Michael. You have an original concept.
It rarely happens. And right below that is one of the bigger flops of the year, The Rhythm Section, a thriller starring Blake Lively. It cost about $50 million to make. And every day and hour as it came closer to opening and then into the weekend, the prospects for the movie seemed to dim. It opened on more than 3,000 screens. It made $2.8 million in North America. I think that's a record low for that wide of an opening. Right below that is a Turkish comedy, El Tierin Savasi, or Battle of Elts, ELTS. I don't know what Elts is. I tried to figure it out and I couldn't. It looks like two women who are popular on social media compete for romance. That's what it looks like to me. That made about $2 million. And right below that is an Arabic film called Alamak, or Your Mother. That made about $1.6 million. I don't know what these movies are, and we are missing stats and information on films like Sheep Without a Shepherd and a couple other Chinese films that probably fell off the charts. So there's probably no box office info we're missing about that. But if you know about these Turkish comedy or this Arabic film or more information about the Italian comedy so I can make my pitch, let us know.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox. And you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox.
Well, you know, it's award season, and we'll get to Sundance when we are at Inside Baseball because you were there and can give us a great rundown. But looking at the other awards, what's been handed out this week? What did the Art Directors Guild say?
The Art Directors Guild said, oh, that looks beautiful. No, they said that Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the big winners, I guess what, Parasite one, right?
Right. They have multiple categories. They don't have an overall winner, which I think is a mistake. Art directors, you really should pick one big film. So they have multiple nominees in different areas, you know, like period film, fantasy film, contemporary film. So, you know, that's how you figure out what's what.
So Avengers Endgame won, Parasite won, and Once Upon a Time, in Hollywood won.
That's right. That edged out 1917, which had also done well. So, you know, if you're going to look at tea leaving, I guess the fact that 1917 didn't beat Once Upon a Time means maybe Parasite has a slight advantage.
I like the fact that you turned tea leaves into tea leaving. You turned it into a verb. It's an action verb now.
That's right. The Writers Guild of America also gave out their awards in between picketing. Best Original Screenplay, Parasite. Best Adapted Screenplay, Jojo Rabbit. So again, the film 1917 came up short there. So that's two areas where they came up a little bit short. So before you go gaga over the BAFTAs, just recognize there were two more areas where 1917 might have won, but they didn't.
No, Gaga was last year for A Star Is Born. A Star Is Born. FYI.
Well, I believe I checked at the WGA Awards that 1917 was eligible, because I wanted to be sure about that. You know what I mean? Because the Writers Guild of America, not all international films are available. But I believe, yes, 1917 was in fact nominated. So it did lose out to Parasite.
But you know, just FYI, first of all, Parasite's Korean, so it didn't necessarily have to be American, number one. Number two, the WGA is not on strike yet.
Yeah, well, they're just warming up the picketing.
Yeah, they're building the signs. They're making the signs.
They are indeed, and they're going to be very clever. So what happened at the BAFTAs? 1917. The Germans lost, the British won, and that was the story at the BAFTAs. It won picture, director, cinematography, sound, production design. 1917 won seven awards in all. However, best international film, not in the English language, Parasite. And best acting, no Brits. You're tired of the Brits coming to America and winning Tonys and Oscars and Emmys? Well, we can show them something. All Americans, or at least non-Brits people, winning the acting awards. And yes, it's Joaquin Phoenix for Joker, Renee Zellweger for Judy, Brad Pitt for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
And Laura Dern.
And Laura Dern for Marriage Story. So those four have dominated all the way through. You may say to yourself, well, surely the Oscars won't be lockstep with all the others. I wouldn't bet against it.
Yeah, you know, now Brad Pitt could not be at the BAFTAs, okay? So, but he, I don't know who's writing his jokes these days.
They were pretty good.
But he actually sent a speech through Margot Robbie, who was there, and she read it out, and it began with, hey Britain, I hear you recently became single. Join the club.
And then he said he's going to rename his award the Harry, as in Harry, Prince Harry, so I can bring him back to the U.S. In more serious news, the WGA, they may not be picketing yet, but they have gotten a little hardcore here. They are negotiating with studios and production companies, and one of their principal demands as they renegotiate their latest contract is, we want you to only work with talent agencies that are signatories to the WGA agreement, meaning don't work with the big three. How do you think that's going to go over?
Well, big four. I don't think
big
UTA
four.
Is signed.
I beg your pardon.
Yeah, I think that's gonna hurt. And what they're really trying to do now is squeeze those agencies. Absolutely. They're really just trying to make them kind of bring them to their knees.
Heavens to Betsy. Just like the Kansas City Chiefs brought the 49ers to their knees, I guess.
Well, yes, the Kansas City Chiefs won the Super Bowl in the last quarter. They came from behind in a very exciting comeback.
I was more excited by the, wasn't it like 30-something to 20-something? I thought it was a little farther away than that. Was it kind of an exciting end? The first half got...
It was in, the first half it was tied, and then it came out, and the third quarter was all 49ers. It looked like the Chiefs were just going to implode, and then the Kansas City Chiefs came back, and they scored one touchdown to tie it, and then another touchdown to go ahead, and then there was just one that was... The third touchdown they scored in the fourth quarter, that was it. The game was over at that point.
Oh, well, I'm more excited by tennis, but don't talk to me about Djokovic. Anyway, that moves us on.
Who won that?
Well, Djokovic won the men's, and a young American won for the first time in the women's. A very exciting, a breakthrough American star at the Australian Open.
Yes, that's right. That was and now I guess Djokovic was playing Federer.
No, he won.
No, right, but who was playing? He
was playing team.
Ah, okay. You know what? I don't follow tennis unless
not.
You haven't noticed.
Yes, you bet. But this is the American was Sophia Kenin. I'm not sure how to say her name, Kenin or Keenan, but K-E-N-I-N. She was just breaking into the top 10. Now she has won her first slam. So that's very exciting to see. For quite a while now, I've been waiting for some breakthroughs in the men's and women's worldwide, really. We've had the same four men. We've had Serena and very little else happening in the women's for a while. So it's really fun to see a new crop happen. I think it's a big deal that she won.
Oh, I see what you're doing there. That was actually not tennis, Michael. That was called a softball. You were trying to tell me it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, if you're a streamer and need content, we know a great podcast you can invest in. In fact, it's us, by the way, in case you weren't getting that. If you're looking for video, you want to buy a library. When Apple made noises about launching a streamer, everyone anticipated them making a play for 20th Century Fox because they've got the money and Fox has the movies. But they didn't. And now they've launched Apple TV to resounding, well, indifference and poor reviews for both the quality of their shows and the meagerness of their offering. So now Apple is serious about getting a library, and they've got their eyes on MGM. Unfortunately for them, so does Netflix, which is tired of renting content from others, and so they've been making their own. But picking up the MGM library? Come on. That suits them just fine. So now the two are battling it out. Investors sat on? Yeah, I guess investors have sat on the MGM library for more than, what, 10, 15 years now, watching as the leftovers of a bankrupt company slowly became valued at, to what, the tune of $10 billion? With Netflix and Apple joined by Disney Plus, HBO Max, Peacock, I think, Michael, you and I are going to launch a streaming company soon. They know the time to sell is, right now. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. They've got a company. They want to sell it. It hasn't happened yet. I don't know what kept Apple waiting, why they weren't jumping in earlier to snap up some other libraries. You know, if you were going to launch Apple TV, you should have bought some content. And so now they'll probably overpay for MGM, but we'll see who wins. But, you know, we've known for decades now that libraries are just a gold mine. You know, you want to own libraries. You want to own enough movies or TV shows or albums or books. You know, that content is just going to be an eternal source of revenue, and it's always good to have.
Well, and there are rumors that, you know, and by the way, they are just that, rumors that Apple is going to go after, you know, Paramount or Sony, to which I say, yeah, we'll see about that. Now, MoviePass has gone bankrupt.
What?
Big deal. No, just kidding. In other news, the U.S. colonies have declared independence. Hitler is dead and man has walked on the moon.
What?
Sure. You thought MoviePass and its parent company Helios went bankrupt ages ago. Lord knows your MoviePass card stopped working a long time ago, but now it's official. And is it a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal.
What? Wait, hold on. It's a good thing that I have carpeting in here. Otherwise, you would have heard me hit the floor.
Well, first of all, I should apologize to Sperling. We had MoviePass on the show when they were launching, right?
Oh, God, that was literally in 2012.
And I thought, this is stupid. This is a stupid, dumb idea. It's completely unrealistic. It'll never make money. It's moronic. This guy will never get it off the ground. Why are we having him on our show? I'm embarrassed. And, you know, he made it happen, made money, got it launched and did it. And it was, like we said, it was unrealistic. It was absurd. It was unprofitable by its very nature. And yet that didn't mean he couldn't cash in on it, which he did. More power to him. But more,
just so that our listeners understand, you're talking about Stacey Spikes, the original founder of MoviePass, when it was like $25, $35, $45. Mm-hmm. And it had, you know, 20,000 subscribers. He then sold it to Helios and Matheson.
Yes, that's right. But the point is, they also upended the business and really changed it kind of fundamentally. I mean, Every major chain is offering a pass, just like MoviePass now. You can't go to any theater, but you can go to their theater for, you know, $25 a month. That's what I do at AMC. It has made that a realistic way of doing business in the movie world and the theatrical biz. You see indies banding together to launch their own pass, their own similar type of offering. It has become a fixture. It works in the UK. It's working here in the US. It's not perfect. It's not like MoviePass was when it was losing money month to month. It was heaven. You could go anywhere and see a movie, but it really has transformed the business. It's not upended everything. It hasn't changed from the fact that most people still just go to a movie and don't buy a subscription service, but it's always going to be a part of the business, and it might become more of a dominant way of doing things in the next 5 or 10 years. To me, it just makes sense.
Now, you said something about the independents. What service is that?
Well, it hasn't happened yet, but there are people looking to band together, and yeah, you know, that seems to be something that's going to happen. You know, they can't afford to do it on their own, but they can afford to do it together.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, hey, did someone at Live Nation forget to make a campaign contribution to President Trump?
I hope so.
Did that happen?
Yeah. I hope so.
Because the administration usually bends over backwards to support big business. And also Ukrainians, apparently. But the Department of Justice just came out, guns a-blazing, and said the ticketing and performance venue giant has broken its promise to the government and the American people. When Live Nation gobbled up Ticketmaster, it promised not to retaliate against venues that used other ticketing firms for certain shows. Instead, Live Nation repeatedly did, what's the word I'm looking for? Yeah, just that. That's, they did exactly what I just said.
What a shock.
Yeah, and by the way, I wish we had some way of indexing our shows, because I'd pull up the audio when we said that will happen.
Of course.
This is a disaster in the making. This is what will happen. And guess what? It happened. So needless to say, Live Nation told one venue if they didn't use Ticketmaster, the powerhouse company would never hold an event there ever again. Now the Department of Justice insists the restrictions on them should stay in place for another 5 years. They're going to kind of extend the consent decree.
Because they worked so well.
Right. Similarly, StubHub faces renewed attention by UK regulators as it is about to be bought by Viagogo. The UK Competitions and Market Authority also says StubHub keeps breaking the rules. It misleads consumers about the number of tickets available for a show.
Oh,
and doesn't
it's almost
make...
sold out. It's almost sold out. Quick.
Yeah, you better
quick.
Get your ticket right now. The tickets you just bought, by the way, we're now selling to 4 other people. So, yeah. So, you know, they don't make clear how many tickets are for sale. And when people buy tickets on the secondary market, that, for example, the venue it's held at won't honor resold tickets. They don't kind of tell them that. Next thing you know, they're going to insist used car salesmen need to make clear that brand new used cars actually won't start. Big deal or big whoop.
Well, that was a little confusing there. I blame myself here. But yeah, one of the things StubHub was doing was not letting you know, oh, you're buying a resold ticket to go to, say, Madison Square Garden. This isn't true, but maybe Madison Square Garden doesn't honor resold tickets. And they're not saying, oh, you know, you're buying this ticket. Oh, warning, that venue doesn't accept them. You know, they're not bothering to do that. So I think this is all a big whoop, because so what? They're still doing it. So the Department of Justice leaves this oversight in place. Well, it's not working now. So unless you do something new, who cares? StubHub is breaking the rules now. And they're saying, oh, you really shouldn't do that. They're not talking about, you know, they're saying we might, you know, take legal action. Well, what are you waiting for? You know, what's going on here? So they're breaking the rules. No one's doing anything about it.
Yeah, and generally the reality is that when you break a consent decree, there are fines, there are ramifications for that. Basically, what we're saying is, yeah, you broke the rules. You know what we're going to do is keep the rules in place a little bit longer.
We're really angry with you.
Yeah, because consent decrees after 1970, there was an actual time limit on them, right? And so, unlike, say, come on, Michael, you know where this is going.
Oh,
the Paramount decree.
Ka-ching,
the Paramount decree. 25 cents for me. And if you want to find out why we just said that, go back a couple episodes when we discussed the Paramount decree. Exactly. Apparently, I get 25 cents every time I say that. But back then in the 1940s, there was no end to it. So they're just trying to end all this legislation. Well, guess what? Now they're saying, yeah, they're technically after 1970 only supposed to be about 7 years long. We're going to extend that by about 5 years. And to which I say, that's it. They just have to keep doing what they're doing for another 5 years and have you kind of, they're still doing it. So what's the difference? Mm-hmm. I don't know. Anyway, in a victory for artists, two big shows have shortened their runs. We already mentioned that the HBO series Watchmen has stopped after one season. Its creator, Damon Lindelof, doesn't see any creative need for more, and the cabler is backing him up. HBO is saying, yep, you're right. The door isn't completely closed on never returning to the show, inspired by the classic graphic novel, but it ain't happening now, and it might never happen. In a different way, the Netflix series The Crown is also cutting it short. That was pitched as a drama taking place over six seasons. Young Queen Elizabeth, and that would be like season one and two. Middle-aged Queen Elizabeth in season three and four. And the mature Queen Elizabeth in seasons five and six. Now the creators are mapping out the final episodes and realize they would reach the perfect ending in season five, and they're bringing it to Canada. I'm kidding. So we'll get one more season with Olivia Colman, and then Imelda Staunton will take the throne for the fifth and final season. Maybe she'll move to Canada. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. It's just a reflection of how so much has changed in the world of television. For decades, we would look at the UK and think, oh, God, if only American artists could do that. You have to turn out, 22, 30 episodes a season. It's insane in sitcoms and dramas. If only they could make 10 and then wait 2 years and make 8 and then stop and do what creatively makes sense. Well, we're there now. People are free to do that. They make miniseries. They make long form series. They make a telenovela that lasts one long season. They do whatever fits the material. And it's so much better for the audience and for the fans and for artists and for the work that they're doing. It may not always make sense commercially. They'd rather have another couple seasons of Watchmen because it did very well for HBO. But it's the right choice artistically and long term. It's better to have that in their library. So that's great to see. It's great to see The Crown saying, you know what? We don't need a sixth season. And I think streaming has really had a big impact on that. It's just upended television in so many ways. And we'll get to more of that in Sundance.
Yes, that is true. I was going to say, wow, that should have been the last big deal or big whoop piece we did because it literally flows really perfectly into Inside Baseball. But first, let's talk a little bit about how streaming is affecting music and possibly how that is affecting artists and how much they make. Because are music streamers making more music available to more people than ever before? I think we'd say yes, right? Mm-hmm. Well, that's one possibility when you look at the payouts made by SoundExchange, a middleman, so a performing rights organization, and they collect payments from music streamers and satellite radio. Like radio actually too, by the way. And they make it available to the appropriate labels and artists. They take the money in and then they dish it out. Since 2008, its payouts have grown from $100 million to $900 million. But while the pie has grown bigger, the last few years have seen the slices grow smaller. It appears more artists are benefiting, so average payouts are growing smaller, but the number of acts benefiting is growing larger. So instead of the lion's share of the money going to Ed Sheeran and Lizzo and the like, more money is going to mid and lower tier acts than ever before. In the fourth quarter, the number of acts getting checks grew by 8%, but the payouts fell from a median of $10,000 per, I guess, artist to $6,000. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's hard to tell because I don't think we have enough numbers. You had one point to make about the numbers that are missing here, didn't you?
Yeah, and that is, you know what? Okay, so you paid out $900 million. Here's my question. How much did you take in?
Right. What are their overhead costs to administer this? It better not be more than a few percent because if they're getting more than 2 or 3%, then they're spending too much money on stuff that they shouldn't be. You know, it should be going through as cleanly as possible to get to the artists and labels. SoundExchange is now saying, well, hey, we'd like to make money too. Yes, I bet you would. But it's so hard to know. You know, the number of acts getting money grew by 8%, but it looks like payouts fell almost 40% on average. So it looks like more money is getting dispersed among more and more artists, but that disparity is not lined up. You know, it sounds like the amount of money being paid out dropped a lot more than the number of acts grew. If the acts grew by 40% and the payouts dropped by 5%, then you'd be saying something. But 10,000 to 6,000 per act median payout. You know, obviously Drake and Ed Sheeran and Beyonce are getting a lot more than that, and a lot of other people are getting less. They're trying to tell us, hey, this is great. More people are listening to more different types of music, and so more mid-range and niche artists are getting, you know, money that they can maybe actually live on. Well, that would be great. But we don't have enough info to know if that's actually happening. And the numbers they provided certainly don't make, you know, don't bear that out. So I feel
what
like
I would
we
say
really
about Sandy, yeah, and I would say Sound Exchange is very good, and they have always been very good at telling you the numbers they want you to hear.
Like every other company.
Like, yeah, well, yes, but in this case, you know, they have a lot of money that they keep on hold because they can't pay it because they don't have the artist's contact information or they don't know where to pay it to.
Well, there's a whole problem of what is it called? Oh, heck. It's all the data information, not data mining, but there's a phrase that I keep using in different articles in the industry about, you know, tagging music properly so that you know who gets what, where, when. They're trying to use, you know, blockchain technology now to help make it easier to track music and who is supposed to get paid for it. Because, yeah, that's a big problem. They just have to sit on a pile of money because they claim, well, I don't know who wrote this song. You know, it's tricky. It's difficult. It's very complex, but they should be figuring it out by now.
And, you know, here's a really good solution to it. And Michael, I think you'd agree with me. Mm-hmm. Just send the money to us.
Absolutely. That would work. And then we can buy a baseball team rather than talk about inside baseball. But it is time for that section, Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this affects you, Sperling, because you were at Sundance. We can talk about the awards. The big winner was the fiction film Minari, which won the Grand Jury Prize, the top prize from the critics, you know, the people at the festival, and the Audience Award, which is highly prized. When you win both of them, you are a slam dunk for some good attention from the media. And when it comes to docs, there was sort of a split. The big critical winner was Boys State, and the big audience winner was Crip Camp. So those both got a good amount of buzz coming out of Sundance. So that's three films at the very least that you really want to pay attention to. The big question is, was it worth your time to be there?
Yes, because, you know, you always want to know what is going to happen over the next year and what are the trends in content and in distribution and, frankly, even in exhibition, because there are exhibitors that go to Sundance. And frankly, you also get kind of a line on how are films being made? Are they being made on iPhones, which was a trend for a while? Are they being made on Aeroflex cameras? Are they being made on film? Do they require big stars? And, you know, we had a film made on what looked like GoPros. You know, GoPros all like, and iPhones, you know, Spree, for instance, was that film. So, you know, that's one reason to keep going. There was a couple of years where I decided not to go just because I had other things going on. And, you know, I just decided, but over the past 2 years, it has been worth it. There was no major film this year where it was a revelation where you walked out and went, wow, Winter's Bone was really, really good. I think that I don't know who that actress is, but she's going to have a big future. And of course, that was Jennifer Lawrence.
Are there any films that will be on your best of the year list that you anticipate? Did you just say this is a good enough film to be on my best of the year list?
Ooh, Shirley, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Shirley was very, very good. It stars Elizabeth Moss and Odessa Young in a film that was directed by the person who, it's a woman, and she directed Madeline's Madeline. I did not see some of the Josephine Decker is who directed that, by the way. I didn't see some of the big pickups. So, and what I mean by that is, of course, studios, distributors, and now streamers, as we will talk about in a moment, they show up at Sundance and they want to acquire films that they can release in theaters and now on their platforms throughout the rest of the year. And so I didn't see Uncle Frank. I didn't see, you know, Bad Hair or The Night House, which was picked up by Searchlight Pictures for, I think, $12 million. Mm-hmm. Now that's going to get a traditional theatrical release. But then Palm Springs was pretty good. And you know, there were documentaries that I still say are fantastic, like The Truffle Hunters, which was picked up for $1.5 million by Sony Pictures Classics. Now that is what I call a legitimate and right pickup, the right price for the right film from the right distributor.
Well, normally at Sundance, we only talk about the films. We don't talk about the behind the scenes machinations. It's usually just Robert Redford saying, hey, enjoy the movies. And then we watch the films. But this year there's a new head. They just announced, after looking far and wide, they decided they had the right person right at home. And Tabitha Jackson is the new director of Sundance.
Yeah, John Cooper he's been the artistic director and head of Sundance now for the past 11 years. He's been with Sundance for 30 years. I remember first dealing with him in the 90s. He was one of the shorts programmers. So he would be the one that went through all the shorts and picked which shorts
paying your dues.
Yes, he paid his dues. And he's like, okay, 30 years, I'm kind of done.
Starting with the shorts, that's paying your dues.
Oh, yes, very much so. So, you know, for a while, Jeff Gilmore did it. Then it was John Cooper. Now he's leaving. And Tabitha Jackson, who was in charge of the Sundance Institute's documentary program. So that means their documentary lab and all of that. She was, an internal choice, but they did look far and wide and then decided to up Tabitha Jackson. So it'll be interesting to see how or if the festival changes with her in charge.
One of the rare women in charge of a major festival.
Kim Yatani, who is both Asian and a woman, by the way, she has been kind of working with John Cooper for the past 2 or 3 years. So she's been, in charge to some degree.
Mm-hmm. But there's Toronto, Cannes, Venice, Berlin. Are there any women in charge anywhere else?
I don't believe so. I think at Telluride, yes. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you mentioned Minari, which is, from a Korean-American director, and it's mostly in Korean.
And it's about childhood growing up in Arkansas.
Yes, in 19...
Semi-autobiographical, I should say.
Yes, and it's a very good movie. Yep. You know, very understated. There was another understated movie that I saw that I thought, okay, this is, I don't know who the audience is for this movie, but boy, is it really good. Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always.
Oh, yeah, I heard good things about that.
Boys State, which, as you say, won the Grand Jury Prize. Fantastic film. And, you know, yes, the experiment that Boys State kind of depicts is, you know, it's the American Legion's Boys State. So
it's like the model UN, where kids in Texas come together and create their own little political world. And it's inspiring and upsetting and fascinating.
Right. And Crip Camp, which is about basically the people who helped get the ADA established and how they all, or at least most of them, wound up going to the same summer camp when they were teenagers, and what that summer camp allowed them to do, how it allowed them to become adults and humans, and realize
were humans.
yes, as opposed to being treated unhumanely, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Became activists and became empowered and realized their full potential.
Yes. Now that movie is on Netflix, as were 9 other movies at this year's Sundance Film Festival.
They picked up 9 films.
No, they have showed up with 10 films this year. I don't know if they picked up any films while they were there, because 10 of them were theirs to begin with.
Well, that brings us to a story in the Washington Post talking about how streaming has changed the Sundance Film Festival and maybe not for the better.
And by the way, that story, I just used that story as kind of a springboard. There were at least 5 other stories I easily could have used.
Saying much of the same thing.
Much of the same thing, which is that, hey, you know what? It used to be that indie distributors or, you know, Hollywood studios, they would show up at Sundance, as we kind of talked about. They want to pick up movies. Maybe they're looking for a film that they could get a little cachet, a little awards cachet on. And they wanted to capture, you know, something that was buzzed about. Like, for instance, Napoleon Dynamite was at Sundance, Reservoir Dogs, Welcome to the Dollhouse, Whiplash, I already mentioned Winter's Bone, Little Miss Sunshine was picked up at Sundance. At the time, it was like, oh my God, $10 million. Oh, that's unheard of. Well, prior to that, Happy Texas was sold for $10 million, picked up by Miramax for $10 million. It bombed. No film was sold for that much money until Little Miss Sunshine came along. and it was picked up for that much money.
This is a story we hear every 5 years, and I sort of rolled my eyes about it again. The people say, oh my God, Miramax or Netflix or Villain of the Week is destroying the independent film world. They're destroying Sundance. They're overpaying for movies. Their life has ended as we know it. And this time, the villain is streamers, and they're saying, streamers have destroyed the world. They're overpaying for films. And more specifically, one of the complaints seems to be they are buying up these films and then they're disappearing into the black hole of information that is streaming. They get played on Netflix, but nobody knows since they're not being shown theatrically, since we're not having any box office to judge it on. They barely get reviewed because they go by so fast. So how do we know if they made the right decision? And I say, well, it's not the job of a film festival to give critics like us some job to do and a scorecard so we can keep it. But you feel they have a certain point to make. And it's while, of course, things always change and evolve and grow. And of course, every few years, somebody new is overpaying for movies and then it settles down and then they start to overpay again and then it settles down and then they over, you know, that keeps continuing. You feel like there is a valid point or two to be made.
Right. I mean, think about it this way. You know, right now, if, for instance, Happy Texas sells for $10 million, well, the year after that, when somebody comes along and says, hey, my film is worth $10 million too, you could say, well, actually, funny thing, you should mention that Happy Texas wasn't worth $10 million. Look at how much it made. And then prices kind of come back to a more realistic level. And it's kind of like the person who sells their house on your block for, you know, three times what its value is, well, then every other person on the block wants their house to sell for that price, even if their house is falling over. Well, you know, all of these other distributors who are trying to pick up movies, their struggle now is, well, I don't think this film is Palm Springs, for instance, was picked up. That's the Andy Samberg movie that was at Sundance. It's the it's a comedy. It's basically a new twist on Groundhog Day. Mm-hmm.
How was, you know, Bill Murray's Groundhog ad?
That was actually funny.
Uh-huh.
And we're talking about the Super Bowl ad, by the way, for those
That's
of
right.
you.
Not, I did not yeah. watch the Super Bowl.
And so, you know, Neon probably came along and said, yeah, that movie, if I bought it for $7 million, I could easily, you know, market it for another seven and maybe get 25 out of it. And then I'm in the clear. You know, I made some money, especially since I'll own it for, well, I don't know, I could sell it to a streamer or I could make some money. Well, a streamer came along and said, well, I'll pay a lot of money for it. I'll pay 15 for it. Well, Neon decided, you know what? The only way to do this is to team up with Hulu or a streamer. We'll both put in X amount of money and they'll get it for streaming. We'll get it for theatrical. The filmmakers, the producers, will get $17.5 million and 69 cents, by the way, just to make it, you know,
a record.
And they picked 69 for a reason. I'll leave that to your imagination as to why.
Behave yourself.
Hey, they should behave themselves. So really what I'm trying to say is it, you're right. This happens all the time. People come along, they spend too much. The prices come back down after people go, you know, those films weren't worth that much money. And hey, filmmakers, stop asking for that much money. Look at what happened to all those other people. All those other filmmakers,
didn't
deserve that much
money.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, look at what happened to the distributors of those movies. They got burned. So we're not going to get burned. You have to take a lower amount. Well, guess what? That's not the case for the next couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, people worried about independence and scrappy little people are going to be pushed out of the market. The one thing I feel confident about, whether you're talking about Broadway or movies or music, there are always going to be people pursuing their dream with a crazy idea that they've got a great script, they've got a great movie, they're going to make it on a dime, they're going to make it happen, or they're going to be a scrappy distributor who's going to pick up stuff that nobody else sees value in, and they're going to make it and turn it into gold. I mean, that's just going to keep happening no matter what.
Oh, absolutely.
So,
yeah,
you know, streaming.
I guess the question is, and this is Carrie Putnam, I guess she's one of the directors of the Sundance Institute. She's the executive director of the Sundance Institute. She kind of mentioned this in the first day. They didn't have a press conference this year. They just kind of had a day one press kit. She kind of mentioned that really it's increasingly, you know, the content that they're getting, they can see that it's being steered by what the streamers want, by what by what filmmakers and producers believe streamers want.
What does that mean? Because streamers make everything from Bird Box to award-winning films. They seem to be making movies of all quality. So what are you saying? They want all sorts of things and they want it to be good.
Yeah, I don't know. The fear, as you mentioned, Michael, is that, the little guys, let's say a Bleecker Street or an A24, that once the streamer stops showing up, like, for instance, Boys State, we talked about it, well, Apple and A24 picked it up for $10 million. This is a documentary, okay? This is not a narrative film. Can a documentary make $10 million? Theatrically?
Virtually probably, never.
Yeah, probably not. So is the film worth $10 million? Well, to Apple, we're talking about them now. And if you want to see this movie, you either have to go to the theater when A24 releases it or subscribe to Apple TV Plus. And that is what these streamers are doing. They're paying a little bit too much because they're trying to capture the bragging rights or the buzz and get a little trickle-down cachet. And frankly, attract subscribers. And that's the game they're playing. Whereas the traditional distributors, their game is, I've got to actually make money back theatrically and or through selling on ancillary rights. I'm playing the game the way it's always been played. I can't pay too much for it. And the streamers are kind of forcing my hand here or only giving me the leftovers. Well, I agree with you, Michael. I think time will tell. I'm pretty sure the A24s of the world will still be around in, 5 years. The question is, will new players come onto the scene? I'm not so sure.
They always do. But one person who won't be
Look, I hope so. I hope so.
One person who won't be around is TV executive Fred Silverman. He died at 82. He was a legend in the TV biz. And I have to admit, I was always a Brandon Tartikoff guy. As a dorky little kid, I was really into network programming and how you scheduled prime time. Isn't that sad?
You want to know something funny? I actually wrote a teleplay that starred that featured Bill Cosby and Brandon Tartikoff. It was like Radio Days, but for TV. And Brandon Tartikoff was one of the characters, and I won the Scholastic screenplay writing contest. Oh. In 19, I think it was 88, 89, something to that effect.
Then you said, I'll just hire people to do it for me.
And then I said, write them. I'll represent them.
So I thought of Fred Silverman as sort of a schlocky guy who dealt in a lot of junk. But looking at his career, he made a lot of really smart choices and helped make a lot of great TV happen. He headed all three major networks back when that meant something. ABC, CBS, and NBC. They were the only game in town, people. And in his early 30s, to begin with, he jumped from CBS daytime to the primetime schedule. He was a very young head of CBS. And when ABC rejected the pilot for All in the Family, he jumped. He says another exec greenlit the show, but he made the choice to move it from a deadly dull slot on Tuesday to Saturday nights alongside the Mary Tyler Moore Show, thus beginning one of the legendary nights of quality television in TV history. Then they had spinoffs and hits like Maude and Rhoda. He was responsible.
The Jeffersons.
Oh, right? Absolutely. He was responsible for the Heartland Massacre. I made up that name, but that was where CBS canceled successful but lowbrow shows like the Beverly Hillbillies and Petticoat Junction to make way for sophisticated urban fare. That turned CBS into the Tiffany Network, and it put Fred Silverman on the cover of Time magazine. But he had flops, the shows that I remember, like Super Train and that one with BJ and the Bear or whatever, and the Alan Thicke talk show that was going to compete against Johnny Carson. But you know what? Norman Lear went to Twitter and he said there would be no All in the Family or Maude without Fred Silverman. And so he had a huge success at CBS. And then he jumped to ABC, and who was like also ran perennially, and he did it again. When he left for NBC, ABC was number one with Laverne and Shirley, The Love Boat, Fantasy Island, that's where you're talking schlock, and then Soap, which he's supported, and the miniseries Roots, which happened under his tenure. Billy Crystal gave him a shout out for being so supportive. He also had Entertainment take over Good Morning America, and he made David Hartman the host. That was a radical change. And in the afternoon during the soaps, he sexed up the daytime soaps and made them hipper and younger by doing a lot of different things there, branding them and really making them good, a General Hospital. That was the biggest soap of all for a number of years.
It was also, well, wait a second. If he was there with Laverne and Shirley, he must have been there with Happy Days, right?
Well, Happy Days had happened first, I believe, before he jumped to ABC. He was not, I don't think he got credit for that. But he was also behind The Waltons, The Facts of Life, Three's Company, the big reality breakthrough of Real People, and Charlie's Angels. He became nicknamed the man with the golden gut. He came up with the idea of Scooby-Doo. He relaunched The Price is Right and launched Family Feud. He couldn't do his magic at NBC. He was there for a few years. But while he was there, he launched Hill Street Blues, Cheers, and David Letterman with a morning show. And then when that show flopped, he signed him to a long contract and said, I made the mistake. David Letterman did not. He is a talent, and we're going to make him happen. And by God, they did. He also put Brandon Tartikoff in charge of programming. Then he was an independent producer. Matlock, Jake and the Fat Man, In the Heat of the Night, Diagnosis Murder, all sort of middle brow mystery kind of programming. But by God, they made a lot of money. As a little kid, he loved radio. When he was 10 to 12 years old, this is what the Times said, he would go to radio stations in New York City and convince the porters there who loved this little kid who came by and said, I love radio. He would get them to dish out the scripts that were being thrown out. And at one point, he had 4,000 to 5,000 scripts in his library. He ended up donating them to his alma mater. But I mean, that's a dorky kid. I mean, what a fascinating career. He really is a major, major player in television. He'll be sorely missed. And I now appreciate him a lot more than I did at the time.
Well, also dying was Harriet Frank Jr. She died at the age of 96.
That's right. She was an Oscar nominee. She was partnered with her husband, the late Irving Ravitch, on multiple screenplays. He saw her in the hallway at like a studio and said, I like that girl. And he went to a guy who was had his office next to her and said, I'll pay you $50 to move out. That guy moved out and he moved in and they became friends and then lovers and got married. She said, any man who comes to you every morning and reads the New York Times to you, you got to marry him. So they were married, but they worked separately. He worked here. She worked there. They saw each other at the end of the day. And finally, they said, this is ridiculous. And they started working together and they had big success. They were Oscar nominees for Hud and Norma Rae. They also did The Long Hot Summer, The Reavers, Murphy's Romance, yet another film when you're looking at movies and saying, why wasn't James Garner a bigger movie star?
I agree, yeah.
I mean, but he was really a great TV star, that's for sure. They co-wrote 17 films, including 8 of them, with director Martin Ritt, who was coming back from The Blacklist when they worked with him. They also did 3 films based on James Faulkner novels, which is a bizarre thing to do. And their collaboration with Ritt was really, really close. Her husband said in one interview, on every single one of those 8 films, we were with Marty from the pre-production and casting to the final advertising campaign. These are the writers we're talking about. He says we were also on the set every single day, and he invited us to the rushes every single morning. It was a true collaboration, and we always had a marvelous time. I mean, that sure as heck doesn't happen very much. It's cool to hear about. So goodbye to them, and goodbye to you, I guess, because it's the end of another show.
That's right. You can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free, anywhere they aggregate podcasts, you can find our show. And please do subscribe to the show, and please do rate and review the show in any one of those podcast platforms. It does help us out when you do that. You know, you can find those ways to subscribe to us and links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode. All of that information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That is also where you'll find ways to contact us. You can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can leave us a voicemail at 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. On Twitter, we're at Showbiz Sandbox, and you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Again, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz can be found online, and every week he's got a new and exciting website for us. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's poursomeoutformoviepass.com.
Wow. Okay. That's a callback from the middle of the show. But if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry on that website, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his coverage of the entertainment industry is aggregated. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.